Australia currently, make no mistake, is a tyrannical police state. Its citizens are quite literally being imprisoned against their will. So when do we
get on the beers, get on the beers.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and thanks to US commentator Candace Owen and Victorian Premier Dan Andrews for the intro there. I reckon this track by Candy Moore will be this summer's banger. Absolutely. And of course, for those of you who missed it, Candace Owen was urging the United States to invade the tyrannical police state that is Australia. So yeah, that was fun. I think she was joking, but still went down like a ton of bricks here, obviously. And yeah, what a couple of weeks we've had here in Australia. All lockdowns are over. Travel is opening back up. Our two most popular states are now among the most vaccinated places on the planet. So there was already a really festive atmosphere here in Australia. And then today, we all heard that wonderful news that 4-year-old Cleo Smith, the little girl who was abducted from a tent while sleeping next to her parents in Western Australia, she's been found alive 18 days after being taken. And I know we've got some listeners in the AFP and probably some in WA Police too. So good job to everyone who worked on that case. Just amazing stuff. And well done. Now, of course, I am back on deck after a couple of weeks off. We were doing things like, what did I do? I installed a Google Nest Wi-Fi at home, did some irrigation, worked on improving our baby's sleep, which went well, by the way. And thanks to those of you who asked and sent me messages about that. No, we did not do Cry It Out, but thank you for your concern. Ready to get back into it. And we'll be chatting with Adam Boileau in just a moment about all of the news we missed over the last few weeks. There's quite a lot of it and some good stuff in there as well. And then we'll be hearing from Senatas CEO Andrew Wilson in this week's sponsor interview, and he's joining us to talk about how the global semiconductor shortage is making him a very, very sad panda. Now, I don't often recommend sponsor interviews as must listens, but I found the conversation I had with him about this extremely interesting. There's basically been a perfect storm that's just screwed up the global JIT supply chain for all sorts of stuff, but particularly with semiconductors. Plagues, droughts, fires, and geopolitics have all conspired to put us in an extremely tight spot. So Andrew joins us later to talk about how he's navigating his company, which makes hardware appliances, through this supply chain crunch. Again, as I said, I think it's a must listen. We'll get to that in a little while, but first up, it's time to walk through the security news of the last few weeks with our good friend Adam Boileau from CyberCX. And Adam, where to start? There's been a few things going on, but the one that jumped out to me as being a really interesting story for a number of reasons was an attack against Iranian petrol stations. Tell us about this.
So the reporting that came out of this said that there had been disruption to the petrol supply in Iran, and there were queues outside petrol stations and so on. And that, when you first hear that, you think, oh, well, maybe someone got ransomed, maybe, normal sorts of, I guess normal for these days sorts of things happening. But then, more details came out, and it turned out that the petrol pumps were displaying a message that said, cyber attack, and then had Ayatollah Khomeini's phone number.
Yeah.
And then a number of overhead road signs had been compromised and were displaying messages saying, Khomeini, where's our gas? It now looks like this was a coordinated attack, perhaps on the subsidized fuel card system that's used by many Iranians to, get petrol at a subsidized rate. Net result, widespread chaos reported in a number of media outlets across Iran. Very much looks like a coordinated cyber attack. Gee, I wonder who could be interested in doing that.
I wonder. But yeah, you're right. It does look like it's the government sort of fuel card system where you would have to sort of swipe it to turn on the pump. They were able to get like 50% of petrol stations back up and running by switching over to like a, more manual setup. So I'm not sure that the disruption was complete. But look, if this was a state, gee, I wonder who, this isn't really the sort of norm you'd want to set, is it? Attacks against what are, it's a government subsidy system, but this is civilian infrastructure. When I first read this, it just made me feel a little uncomfortable, I got to be honest.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was sort of a mixed set of emotions when I read this. Because on one hand, like, you look at the hacking side of it, like the technical process of putting together this campaign, and you think, dang, you really got to hand it to them. Like, that's a hell of a good, you know, a good job, right? Wow. And then, yeah, you think about what this means for norms and what this means for, you know, whether it's acceptable to go attack, you know, what is, as you say, like, you could weasel around the edges if you're the lawyer trying to get approval for this. But yeah, it is fundamentally civilian infrastructure. And, you know, I know we've seen some tit for tat, you know, Israeli water supply systems and so on being blamed on Iran.
Well, it's wrong. But, wrong when Iran attacks Israeli water systems.
Yes,
and
it
if
is
this
also
were
wrong, yes.
If this were Israel attacking Iran, you know, petrol stations, that would also be wrong. I guess that's what I'm getting at. And I know, you know, we have a luxury of not living in a country that feels like it's under existential threat from one of its neighbors, but still, like, I just see this as being a path to a pretty bad place.
Yes. I mean, when you consider the, like, US retaliation back when, like, Iran shot down an American drone or something, and then there was this, you know, we're going to go and blow up some stuff. And then eventually that got turned into a cyber response against some of the, like, air defense systems in Iran that was, you know, military target, somewhat more proportional, somewhat within perhaps the norms of what's going on there. You know, not an attack against civilian infrastructure. That felt a bit more proportional. This feels a little bit out of whack. And certainly, you know, when you compare with the disruption caused by the Colonial Pipeline ransom, and you think, like, imagine if that Colonial ransomware thing was actually Iranian, do you think the Americans would be particularly happy about that? No, right? I mean, they would be arguing that that crossed the line. And I imagine there's probably people in Washington arguing that this crossed the line, you know, because the Americans do, you know, I guess, endeavor to go for a more proportionate response than perhaps Israel does. But as you say, right, I mean, Iran has said that Israel should be annihilated. So you can kind of see why they're a little bit salty.
Yeah. And look, we don't know if it was Israel, right? Iran has more than one enemy.
But it's just real smooth. Like, this, it has that kind of, you know, smooth polish that you expect from an Israeli op that's just, you know, you got to hand it to them kind of thing.
Yeah,
know?
No. I get it. But, like, I'm just whacking that caveat on it. We don't actually know, right?
So,
and I haven't heard anything from, you know, sources or anything like that. But, I mean, that would be, if you had to guess, if you had a gun to your head and had to guess, you would probably say Israel. But, no, I'm glad we're on the same page with that. I think it's a bit concerning. Now, look, there is a ransomware story that I want to talk about because I think it's a very interesting one. We will have, like, an entire ransomware section in this show because, you know, obviously after a couple of weeks off, I come back, I sit down in front of a list of, you know, 15 pages of links to news articles. And I think after trimming the boring ones, we still were left with 29 ransomware related stories, right, in this week's run sheet. So there's no way we're going to be able to go in depth on them all. But this one is very interesting. The government in Papua New Guinea, which is obviously, you know, Australia's closest neighbour, the government there has suffered a ransomware attack affecting its ability to pay money to people. Right. And this is a very big problem. Now, it looks like they're soldiering on. They haven't paid. It looks like they've got things up and going in a limited capacity, but there's a little bit of confusion as to just how successful they've been. Now, the reason I find this one interesting is if this were to destabilize PNG, right, this would be a big problem for the region. Okay, you're talking about, you know, a loss of order, a loss of security. You could have anywhere between a refugee crisis to a civil war, and that's really what's at stake when you're talking about some of these ransomware attacks.
Yeah, so in this case, the PNG government has they call it the Integrated Financial Management System. So they have one central all-of-government process for, you know, handling payments to, you know, officials, you know, people who work for the government and suppliers and all those kinds of things. So, you know, this is a big deal. Like, I mean, this is their ability to pay doctors and nurses who are dealing with, you know, the COVID situation there. In the middle of a pandemic, government can't pay money to people. Like, it is really, you know, you could imagine, as you say, you know, collapse of social order and onwards to the government being, you know, unable to do its job, civil war, who knows what else. This is a really serious and, you know, really horrid situation. And, you know, PNG is, you know, a country that has a bunch of challenges. And, you know, you can understand that cybersecurity is kind of not really on the top of their list of things, you know, that they have to deal with there.
Attacking a country like PNG in this way is despicable, right? And they are in the middle of a COVID crisis and their healthcare system is under a lot of strain because apparently a lot of the healthcare workers have COVID. So are isolating, they can't work. So it's just things are already so bad there right now. Now, look, I don't know if there is actually a civil war risk, right, in PNG. I'm not really in tune with the, with the domestic politics there, but certainly in the past it has been a pretty unstable place. So I guess, you know, my point is that when you attack a poor, vulnerable, volatile place, who knows what the end result's going to be.
And for context, they have what, below 1% of population fully vaccinated for COVID?
Yeah, something right? like that. It's bad.
Yeah. It's, so it's, you know, it is really bad. And, you know, as to what the fallout would be in the region, you know, if something went badly wrong, obviously Australia as the closest neighbour, you know, is the one that's most likely to, you know, step up and help.
Well, but, I mean, if they would ask, which they probably wouldn't, because PNG is a former Australian colony, and the last thing they want to see is our soldiers on their territory, right? But that's kind of part of the whole thing, which is it's just a mess. Okay, is what I'm getting at is here is a ransomware attack that has serious regional sort of stability implications, and I can't believe that we've let it get this bad.
Yes, like that. Yeah, exactly. Right. This is a real mess. Like, if you take out the entire ability of a government to function like this, you know, I guess they don't really have hounds. They can't really pay their hounds if they have any hounds. But, I mean, like, what else are they for if not this, you know?
Yeah. I mean, but that's sadly a line that we've had to say many times on this show, and not much seems to be happening. But there's a little bit of movement at the station. Yeah. We'll get to that in a little while. And it looks like the National Bank of Pakistan is – I mean, look, I read this story and it says to me either someone did a ransomware attack and messed something up, or this is actually a wiper attack.
Yes, so the reporting is that the National Bank of Pakistan has been attacked and a number of their core systems, you know, made non-functional, back-end networking systems, ATM network for their cash machines, mobile applications, all kind of offline. And we've seen some screenshots of, you know, the blue screen when their Windows machines fail to boot that have apparently been kind of confirmed as coming from their environment. They have managed to get some services back up, and of course there was a run on the ATMs, you know, in the morning when they brought them up because people were concerned about having enough money available to them. There was also reporting of kind of widespread attacks on many banks. Pakistan Central Bank has come out and said that that's not the case. It was just the one bank. But, yeah, whether it's a wiper attack, you know, and that would be, you know, we've seen wiper attacks on banks before. Whether it's just ransomware or something else, we don't know. But it looks closer to wiper from what we've seen reporting, which is interesting. You know, it's been a while since one of those went through.
Yeah, and you just sort of wonder, why would you stage a wiper attack? You know, why would you mount a wiper attack against a bank in Pakistan? So that's one maybe we'll keep an eye on it and see if anything becomes clearer. Microsoft dropped an interesting report on Holiday Bear, or as they call them, Nebelium. This, I think, is interesting. So they say that Nebelium attacked more than 140 IT and cloud service providers and successfully breached 14 of them. I found this interesting, right? Because I think when this first, when the whole, and of course this is the same group behind the SolarWinds stuff, and, you know, when in all of our discussions about the SolarWinds campaign, we kept coming back to the same thing, saying what makes this quite interesting is the cloud side to it, right? And this seems to confirm that. Everyone was sort of focused on the supply chain side of it, but it was really the fact that these attackers are very good at navigating modern cloud environments. It's sort of like they're picking up where Cloud Hopper left off, you know, taking what the Chinese pioneered and, you know, extending it forward. But this is interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And Microsoft, of course, has great visibility to be able to go and kind of pull this thread in a way that many other organizations can't, because they have visibility of service providers that, you know, as an outsider, someone consuming services provided by a service provider, you really don't have much visibility, whereas Microsoft can kind of look from their perspective. So that's really helpful to get some kind of numbers, some scale. But yeah, the similarity to Cloud Hopper, you know, where the Chinese went into a bunch of big service providers and downstream towards customers and onwards towards the, you know, US military. Yeah, similarity is pretty stark. Obviously, we've moved a whole bunch more stuff into the cloud and managed and outsourced a lot more things since Cloud Hopper. So the technique is perhaps even more useful and viable and likely than it has ever been. So good big providers like Microsoft are looking into it. You know, I kind of imagine that this is where everyone's going to head.
Well, it's interesting, right? Like, because everything's cloud now. And you look at the way that we've done it, because there's been that rapid acceleration in cloud deployments, it's just got very complicated, particularly like the, you know, accounts and roles and all of that stuff is just, you look at that on a graph and it's more complicated. You know, the whole idea about moving to the cloud was, oh, it's going to be really simple, but it just hasn't worked out that way.
Yeah, I mean, if you move to one cloud and you only do one thing, it's probably more straightforward than having it all on-prem and managing it yourself. But for most people, you're bodging together services from all sorts of providers and, you know, SSO authing things of other things and SAMLing things to other things. And you draw that graph, as you say, and it just gets nuts. I'm trying to understand when the cloud environments are engineering themselves while you're using it, like changing stuff around and adding new things. It's really, really difficult to keep hold of. And then on the other side of that, we've also, you know, learned that multi-factor auth is good, and, you know, a lot of cloud services are requiring you to use multi-factor auth effectively. And much like, you know, the battle for network, you know, end-to-end crypto leading to us having to compromise devices at the edge of the network to see content for SIGINT agencies, the same is true here, right? If we make the end user auth really, really good, which we're heading towards, doesn't make the demand to break into people's stuff go away. It just means you have to go another way. And if you're SVR or, you know, the Chinese or whoever else, why not do the thing that works, which is go up through the vendors and service providers and come around that way rather than phishing end users and going in through the front door?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've got another story we're going to talk about later where people have been getting their YouTube channels taken away from them by crypto scammers, and they're doing that with malware and just stealing session cookies, right, to get away to get around MFA controls, right? So, you know, MFA is great, but it doesn't solve maybe as many problems as people think it does, you know? So there's that. Now, look, we spoke about this, I think, the last show before we went on break, which was this attack against bandwidth.com. And I remember we were talking about it and saying, well, it's not really getting much attention, but bandwidth.com running out of bandwidth seems kind of newsworthy to us. And it looks like that was part of a very broad DDoS campaign targeting VoIP providers. So it was definitely DDoS for extortion. But yeah, it's been hitting providers in the UK, hitting providers in the US. And of course, you know, VoIP services are all UDP. So it makes sense for DDoS crews to target them because, you know, you've got more limited filtering options.
Yeah, so that's the thing I think is real smart about this. And then we segue into our usual section of how to improve your business model if you're a criminal. The fact that Cloudflare and other CDNs have been so effective at stopping, or at least providing tools for very rapidly mitigating web-based denial of service, making a pivot back to what other services are really important that you can't just run through Cloudflare 10 minutes after you get DOSed.
Yep.
Is a really great way to go find some things to do. And VoIP is a very natural target. You know, the availability of phone systems we take for granted. People have moved to VoIP for cost reasons, and people don't even necessarily understand that their call centers or their emergency services, you know, numbers or whatever else are transiting VoIP somewhere in the back end because, you know, it just looks like phone system from the outside. So yeah, this is a real smart move. I don't know if they've got much money out of it yet, but, you know, in terms of figuring out what to target that's valuable and can't be Cloudflared, yeah, VoIP makes a lot of sense and makes me wonder what other stuff fits in that kind of category.
I'm pretty sure bandwidth.com did work with Cloudflare to mitigate this, actually. But yeah, I know what you mean. You can't just CDN it away. Yes. But I think also it's less of an existential threat compared to something like ransomware because, you know, ultimately you just got to get better at automating the filtering and the blocking and the, you know, there's stuff you can do. It's just a pain, but it can be done. And meanwhile, you know, bandwidth.com says, I think it's going to cost them $12 million. They said so in a SEC filing just from the outages that they did experience, which weren't all that long, but yeah, what a nightmare for them.
Yeah, it certainly is. And seeing some numbers like that, I mean, it's one of the good things about having some, you know, requirements from the SEC to be upfront about this. Yeah, it helps make it tangible and real. And that's certainly more than I was imagining, you know, from, you know, taking out some VoIP circuits or something. But yeah, but I guess if that's their core business, makes a lot of sense that it cost them very, very real money.
Yeah, I think I'm seeing numbers bounced around in the order of like 300 gigabit per second. And meanwhile, a bunch of email providers got whacked with a 256 gigabit per second attack, according to another report from Catalin Campanu at The Record.
Yeah, it's not clear whether these two campaigns are related in terms of who's doing it, but yeah, hitting a bunch of web-based email providers and then asking them for ransom. And these are pretty small ransoms. Like, this was in the order of like $4,000 worth of Bitcoin kind of thing. So pretty small chump change, but, you know, I guess this is, you know, like this kind of DOS for extortion, you know, it's been going on for a long time now, and clearly there's some, you know, people still doing it. And, you know, maybe you know, if you make $4,000 out of a campaign, then hey, that's pays the bills for
that's
the month.
That's a win, you know? Question mark? Yeah. Yeah, I was surprised about the VoIP stuff though, because like I, you know, it was Tom Lawrence put me onto that. He did a YouTube video about it, and he, you know, sent me a link. And Tom has a YouTube channel with like, you know, hundreds of thousands of subscribers. He's an IT professional in the United States, but he had some insight. He knew someone who was, you know, in that sort of VoIP business who was being affected by this stuff. And yeah, he was just saying like, this is such a big deal, and there was no press coverage on it for ages. So it's interesting seeing it sort of pop up now a couple of weeks later. And let's just see if they have ongoing drama or if they've actually got the procedures in place now that can mitigate all that stuff. Because you'd think if this turns into an ongoing issue, it's just, you know, it's just a headache that nobody needs. Let's turn to some American news now. And the FCC has revoked China Telecom America's license. So China Telecom has to leave the US. Now, this is something that was first flagged under the Trump administration. When it first came up, I remember you and me, we were saying like, oh, this looks like more trade war bullshit. And then I got pulled up by someone, you know, who is in a good position to know whether or not that's true. And they were like, no, China Telecom is really quite egregiously bad at enabling espionage from Chinese intelligence agencies. So I'm not at all surprised to see this news.
No, you did convey some of the substance of that to me after you got that that suggestion that perhaps we were off the mark there. And yeah, I mean, I guess the, you know, organization like this wants to do the bidding of the Chinese government. It's right there in the name, after all. And, you know, being a telco, very, very convenient, especially telco that operates mobile services as well. So yeah, the fact that they're going to throw it out, they've been operating in the US, what, 20 years now, I think. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that work there who will be wondering what this means for their jobs, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, given that so many Chinese companies, i.e. all of them, have to do the bidding of the Chinese government, like this does feel, you know, I guess they're starting with the ones that are egregiously doing bad things, but it does make you wonder then, like, if you're the Chinese government, you're just going to go, okay, well, next Chinese company, please. Like, it's not like they've got the shortage of...
Yeah, but I heard, I mean, you know, facilitate. I heard that they essentially operate as an extension of the intelligence agencies, right? Like, that it's that bad. They're like, you know, yeah. Patrick, you were wrong and very, really quite a lot about that. So China Telecom, gone. It's funny too, when Tom ran last week's newsletter, he mentioned this and he found a quote from some senior US official that said they were taking a look at DJI, the drone company, because they described it as Huawei with wings, which I thought was really funny. Tom found a way to get that quote into the newsletter because it was just gone. Nice. But look, staying with China stuff, and LinkedIn is actually pulling out of China. Both of these stories that we're discussing came from Dina Temple Rustin at The Record. But yeah, they just don't want to have to comply with a bunch of the laws over there, which would have them, you know, really just have to do whatever the government tells them.
Which, I mean, kind of is the case for everybody operating in China, but interesting because LinkedIn has been there for a while, but with like a subset of the features of the, you know, Western LinkedIn, like less commenting and stuff to try and remove some of the censorship overhead for them. But yeah, it sounds like they're going to pair it back to just being like an online job listing with no ability to post or comment or do other, you know, other things that require censorship to comply with Chinese law. So yeah, stepping it back. And it, you know, really the more companies that are forced to exit, you know, markets like Russia and China, does put the pressure on those that remain, you know, the ones that like Apple, for example, you know, who clearly have.
Yeah, it's different though, because they're not a content platform though, right? And it is kind of different. And I don't know, man. You know, that's a whole other conversation. We could do like a 2-hour podcast just on that. Yeah. But I do think it is. I think Apple is a little bit different to organizations that are essentially operating, you know, user-generated content platforms and stuff.
This is true,
that's very different. Yep. Now, Adam, we got to turn our attention to a CrowdStrike write-up. I did read this one when I was on my break because, yeah, I think Tom flagged it for the newsletter. And it just reading this, I was like, Adam's going to love this one. They look at a bunch of attacks against telcos where there's just some really clever hacking going on. Now, this was reported as being part of some China thing, but the attribution to China is extremely weird. Right? So we don't really know who is behind this, but some fun times in this. And do you see what I mean when I read it and I'm like, this reads like an Adam Boileau conference talk?
Yes, I do. Like, this is, you know, obviously telcos have always been a target for signals intelligence.
And Metalstar, but yes.
and you know, and other people, you know, obviously our scene came from the freaking world. So we have a long, you know, the telco is the historical enemy of our people, is what I normally say. So yeah, like this was music to my ears, and seeing, you know, some of the nitty gritty details of, you know, an adversary that's been up in a whole bunch of telcos and GSM mobile network providers and things. And some of the techniques they use for, you know, connecting outbound and hiding their behavior. And, you know, nothing makes me happier than seeing someone going around owning a whole bunch of old school Solaris boxes in the middle of a phone network. Like, that's just, you know, warms the cockles of my heart. So
this was then using GPRS for exfil, right? So, but this is why I found this such an interesting write-up, is because the attackers were clearly just going after the obscure stuff because no one's watching it. You know, you hit the Solaris boxes and then smuggle the data out via GPRS. Who's going to be watching that? I know.
It is a beautiful thing, like plumbing up a GDP tunnel across the network and then out through the GPRS infrastructure. Like, that's, yeah, it's a beautiful thing, you know, and it's the sort of thing that someone who has been in a lot of telcos would come up with, as opposed to, you know, like a modern hacker, you know, some bug bounty kid is never going to have seen so much, because there's no reason, right? Modern networks are much more IP like, much more like real, you know, IP networks, and much less telco-y. And so this, you know, this reads like what you'd expect if you got an old school like Euro phone hacker and told them to, you know, facilitate their local government's intrusion into a, you know, bunch of national telcos. Like, this is what this smells like. But, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of telco hackers from all around the world. But yeah, it's lovely to see this written up. You know, and whether this is, as you say, whether the attribution to China is legit or not, like there was a,
yeah, it was like a single error string or something that had some Chinese characters or something.
Yeah, there's like a hard coded XOR key, which is, you know, Chinese looking, but I mean, you know, who knows, right?
Yeah.
Who knows who it is? And I mean, all SIGINT agencies want to be up in all the telcos
all the time. Yeah, I mean, they track them as Light Basin, also known as UNC 1945. And at this point, Adam, I've got to ask: are you UNC 1945?
I am not.
You are not
UNC.
UNC. Sure, but no. Yeah, that's what you'd say if you were. And meanwhile, you know, the NSA is releasing updated guidance. They issued some guidance in May for the operators of 5G networks, and apparently they're updating that. And in coming weeks, there's going to be a lot more, you know, a bunch of updates to their guidance around how to construct and operate a secure 5G network. And it looks like, you know, the sort of stuff we're seeing come out of NSA lately in terms of guidance, it's been pretty good, right? And I'm guessing if you are working on a security team at a telco that's rolling 5G or has rolled 5G, this is going to be right up your alley.
Yeah, I mean, this is really nice to see, you know, good quality guidance. As we've talked about, you know, lately, the NSA has been really good at this kind of stuff, clearly born of some practical experience and some work in the labs and all that sort of thing. A bunch of this stuff is not necessarily 5G specific. Like, it's just if you're going to build a mobile telco, then, you know, these are things you should be doing regardless of the radio tech you have in play. But there are a few things that are common in, you know, late 4G, modern 5G deployments, you know, increased use of virtualization, reliance on virtualization as a security boundary in your gear, you know, forward deployment of equipment into less trusted physical locations because of the, you know, more distributed nature of the 5G radio access network. So a bunch of stuff like that is specific. But yeah, things like worrying about your supply chain. You know, don't buy a Huawei one if you don't want a Chinese mobile network.
Yeah, but I think the fact that they're calling attention to those sort of things specifically, that's less of a general concern for regular enterprise, right? That someone is going to interdict and fiddle with your equipment when it's on the way to your office, right? I think the fact that NSA is talking about this means that that's kind of a tangible risk.
Yes, and presumably is a thing that is already happening. Yeah. Otherwise, they wouldn't be spending their time on either the thing that's already happening or the thing that they are doing to other people, which, you know, why not both? But yeah, certainly good reading. And like, there's just so much extra complex. I mean, telco stuff's already complicated, but there is just so much extra complexity in the 5G thing, and a bunch of the sort of assumptions that classic mobile operator security architects kind of grew up with in terms of GSM networks and, you know, UMTS 3G networks. Like, there's just a bunch of assumptions that are no longer true that they hold on to quite dearly. And so having a guidance like this that comes from the NSA as opposed to some, you know, beardy hacker nerd, you know, it's good to have another source to point at.
Now, look, we've got a really interesting story from Ella Nakashima here from the Washington Post, looking at how the United States is going full Vassana on hacking tools, right? Now, what makes this interesting is years ago, it looked like the BIS in the United States Bureau, what is it, the Bureau of Industry and Security or something? Bureau of Industry and Security. Wow, I got that right. Yeah, so it looked like the BIS was going to roll out a bunch of regulations around, you know, export controls on things like, you know, hacking tools. But it was kind of poorly defined and people kicked up a big stink and it just wound up, they wound up pulling the pin on it after lobbying from people like Dave Itell and you know, it was just such a big issue years and years ago. Now, it looks like these regulations are being adopted and nobody's saying anything, right? And I think there's, I think that's probably largely because we know what hacking tool vendors look like these days. And it's just much less likely that these sorts of restrictions will catch up, you know, regular pen testers and stuff like that. Is that your take on this as well?
Yeah, it seems like they've done a bit of thinking and tried to structure some of the rules a bit more clearly and make it a bit more, you know, like the intent of Vassana was to control, you know, the types of hacking tool vendors that we've now come to know and love. And, you know, there was a lot of poorly worded stuff that a lot of, you know, nitpicky pen testers got a bit upset about. And I think they've been through a bunch of that nitpicky stuff and now kind of tightened up a bit. And so, for example, it's now clear that this is really meant to apply to stuff that's used for offensive purposes, and like using the same tools for defensive purposes is not regulated unless it's going to specifically governments. So there's, and then there's a list of countries with whom you can't do any of, you know, transfer any hacking technology, like Russia and China. And then to go and get a license for the rest of them, there is a requirement to like identify the end users. If it's private sector, if it's for defensive use, then there really isn't a concern. So it's a bit more controlled than it was previously. It's also very clear that it's not going to, like,
yeah, last time around, people are like, oh, I'm going to get arrested for having Metasploit on my laptop when I go to Fiji. You know, like it was really, it was a bit like that last time.
Yeah, but it was also, there were some concerns. Like, for example, if you found a bug in an open source project that was run out of Europe, like was reporting that bug a thing that was covered? And so a lot of that sort of dumb stuff has been made clear that it does not apply to that. So it's a tighter and more clearly defined, and it's clearly had more input from people who actually work in these industries than the earlier attempts. And given that a number of the other, you know, all of the other signatures to the Vassana arrangement, which is, you know, like 40 whatever countries, already have similar sorts of controls, and the world didn't end, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Vassana is really about restricting dual use tech, and you know, it's about time we sort of had something like this for the United States. Although, you know, when you're typically hearing about people selling to awful places, it's not, you know, we haven't heard much about the American companies, although there was one recently, wasn't there, that did sell something off to a UAE concern. But yeah, what's funny here too is the Washington Post headline is Commerce Department announces new rule aimed at stemming sale of hacking tools to Russia and China. And you just think, well, they don't need your hacking tools, bro. And, you know, the Tianfu Cup was held while I was on break. And geez, you know, talk about a real show of power. You know, the Chinese exploit development scene just flexed hard. It's amazing.
They really, really did.
Yeah. Walk us through what they managed to own, because it was basically everything.
Basically everything, yeah. So, I mean, Tianfu Cup is very similar to the classic Pwn2Own competition where people show up with exploits for a set of predefined software that's been kind of announced in advance, and then they have to kind of demo that live on stage, and it's all very fun and exciting, and they get big rewards. And, yeah, this really felt like a, you know, the kind of arms parade where you drive all your missiles through the, you know, front of your capital city and show off to everybody. And in this case, you know, they've got, you know, they have Windows 10 boxes getting compromised, like fully patched Windows 10, Acrobat Reader, VMware, Google Chrome, and had a full chain Google Chrome plus Sandbox escape, and similar for Apple, like fully patched iOS 15 iPhone, straight up remote code exec, and then Sandbox escape. And I think the person who did that made what, $300,000 was the prize for, like, you know, remote jailbreak, as they call it, like remote code exec.
Yeah.
So that's pretty nice. And I think one company took away, what, 600,000, a total of $1.8 million worth of prizes given out. Or, as you know, you might look at it alternatively, $1.8 million worth of 0 day thrown on the ground and burnt just to show how much other stuff they have on the shelf.
Well, I mean, it's funny, right? Because last year when we, you know, spoke about the Tianfu Cup in a similar way, there's a guy I know who lives in China who was like, no, it's not like that. You know, this isn't, they're not an extension of the state. state. This is about having a thriving local scene. It's like, well, no, because the thriving local scene always eventually gets co-opted by the state. So as much as the people who are participating in this might think this isn't really about Chinese national interest, it kind of is, right?
It kind of is. And we saw those law changes in China that basically forbade Chinese researchers from participating in similar competitions in other countries, and some requirements to kind of share their disclosures, you know, with the Chinese government to evaluate before they went off to the vendors. So we've kind of seen that scene getting tightened up on, and we've seen examples of flaws reported in previous Tianpu Cups being used in the wild by the Chinese government.
Well, we've seen that once, right? And we don't know if that's a coincidence or, you know, it's hard to draw a direct line. But I think the main point is, you know, showing off that you have a workforce that's capable of doing this sort of work is still flex, right? Whether the people who are doing that realize it or not, it is, you know, it's cyber flex, cyber power flex. There we go.
And I think, like in your interview with Mark Dowd, right, he talked about how stockpiling 0 day was really not a thing that happened and wasn't really useful because the maintenance costs outweighed the cost of just finding new fresh bugs that still worked. And so, you know, the idea that you've burnt a bunch of capability by doing this sort of thing doesn't really stack up when you, you know, consider Mark's position on it. And so, yeah, from that point of view, like, it doesn't cost them much to throw 3 week, you know, a couple of month old, 6 month old bugs on the ground, because, as you say, the important thing is that you have the workforce that can make new ones.
Yes.
And that's really what this demonstrates.
That's right. And China, you know, absolutely does. I think we can say it safely. Right? You know, it's not a fluke anymore. You know?
No.
Definitely can't say that. Now, Krebs has this really weird story here about a company called Pax Technology. So, of course, this is from Brian Krebs. The FBI has raided them. They're a point-of-sale company, and I think there's something about weird traffic being observed from their, like, payment terminals. And then the company has since released a statement saying it was some optional geolocation thing, and, you know, that's what the mysterious traffic was. But it's really not clear what's happened here at all.
No, not at all. And, you know, we have seen point-of-sale terminals, of course, get compromised in the past, and we've seen vendors of point-of-sale terminals get compromised. But, yeah, what exactly has happened here?
You don't normally see them getting raided by the FBI, though, right?
No, you don't. And they wouldn't do that for nothing. But, you know, if you think about the available options, like, it could be they are doing bad things, you know, at the behest of the Chinese government or somebody else. It could be that somebody else has broken into them and has helped themselves to the terminals. It could be that it's a geolocation feature and people are jumping at shadows because, oh my God, a Chinese thing sent a packet to a place that wasn't an American IP. And it spiraled into, you know, the FBI raiding them because no one stopped to say, is this a legit feature? I mean, it could be any one of those things, right?
Yeah.
And we don't really know. And we live in a world where every one of those things is entirely possible.
Hooray!
So,
hooray! Now, another thing that happened when I was on break is some NPM package got Trojaned, and it was, crypto miner, thank God. But it was a really popular NPM package, apparently.
Yeah, this was uaparser.js, so I think for parsing user agents, I imagine. Had something like 6 to 7 million weekly downloads, which I guess is like six million people's worth of continuous build things going on. So we don't know how many actual systems use it. But yeah, the guy's account got taken over and then a Trojan version uploaded, which, yeah, I mean, the fact that it's only a crypto miner makes me weep because, you know, obviously there's much better things to be done with that. But yeah, the guy eventually said, you know, this has happened and pulled some of the affected versions, but just goes to show what, you know, that JavaScript supply chain, well, I guess everybody's supply chain, let's be fair, looks like these days. And I mean,
the world that we live in is built on a foundation of rock. A foundation of rock, Adam. The internet and the systems connected to it, unshakable, built completely on rock. anyway, $2 million bug bounty got paid to someone who found a double spend vulnerability in some crypto thing, which is, I found this interesting because I guess this is what those bugs are worth now, because apparently the person who found this bug, if they had been malicious, they could have hoofed it with $850 million. So I guess $2 million is a pretty good deal.
Yeah, this was some kind of mechanism for transferring, cryptocurrency between the Ethereum system and the Polygon system. And there was some kind of smart contract that facilitated that currency exchange. And he came up with some mechanism where you could assert to the gateway that was making Ethereum currency that you had deleted your Polygon currency so that it could be converted into Ethereum, and it would validate that on the blockchain on the Polygon side. And there was some way to kind of present that receipt multiple times and spend, you know, so you could put money around that loop a whole bunch of times and make money, which, you know, that's the sort of bugs that we find in smart contracts and stuff when they get reviewed. So not unexpected. But the thing that made me make a mouth noise, like, when I read this, was the, yes, baby, it's the biggest bug bounty ever paid, but it's also not real money. Like, they didn't get that $2 million that they paid the guy from, like, their actual fiat currency wallet. They just made it up and gave it to him. So,
they printed it. They e-printed it, yes. Yeah. But, I mean, what is real? I mean, they could give him an NFT of a picture of a monkey and call it, say it's $2 million, and I don't know. What a world. What a world. But yeah, you remember when someone found something similar and they actually just did the attack and then everyone was crying and then they wound up giving the money back or something, or most of it at least.
Was that the guy that got offered the CISO job then?
Yeah, I don't know, or something? Like, that's why I try not to pay too much attention to what happens in that whole
cryptocurrency world. It's just such a madness, crazy town that you should stay away from.
It is. Another one from Catalan here. Apparently someone has stolen the government ID database for all people in Argentina.
Yes. So someone is on a forum saying, hey, I will sell you lookups for Argentinian people's ID cards. And, you know, was doing that as a, like, you know, if you'd like to look up one, it'll cost you this much or whatever. And then the Argentinian government came out and said that somebody had used VPN access into the environment where this data is kept to make those queries, and that they had turned off that VPN access and it was all fine. The person who stole the data has now subsequently said, actually, no, I did in fact steal an entire copy of the database via that very VPN, and has done some lookups for people to assert control of that. So that's not great. And yeah, I guess we'll see the entire data set dumped. I mean, at the moment, we've seen the hacker posting on Twitter, you know, details of, you know, famous Argentinians and their ID cards and photograph details and other, you know, other stuff that's in their database. But I don't know what you do about that. Like, how do you come back from your entire national identity database being nicked?
But I mean, this isn't the first time it's happened. No, I mean, it's happened to, you know, half a dozen, a dozen countries already. So
it's just new normal.
Yeah, part of the new normal, right? Normal. Which is entire population-wide databases for entire countries being stolen. Oh, we got one here from Tom Brewster over at Forbes, where he's talking about, you know, attackers using, you know, deepfaked audio to impersonate someone as part of a $35 million heist. This seems like, you know, this isn't the first time we've seen this happen. So it looks like this is now a firmly established technique, which is a shame, because getting someone on the phone used to be a good way to make sure that you weren't being scammed. And now that's not really available to you.
It's not the case anymore, yeah. So this was, there's a bank in Hong Kong, and then I think the UAE is investigating. So I think the money went from the UAE to Hong Kong and then onwards or something like that. But yeah, deepfake tech. Like, when we're at the point where someone makes a software package where you can just do real-time, like, speak into your phone, does speech recognition to text, uses text to generate, you know, deep faked audio, spits it back out the other side. Someone makes an app that packages that up real easily, and you just have to give it some training data. That, you know, that when that whole thing is super straightforward, obviously we'll see this explode, because, as you say, like, it's the way that we used to deal with this, you know, kind of business email compromise, financial fraud. It was phone the person up and talk to them, and now you can't. So yeah. Sucks to be everybody.
Yeah, basically.
Except criminals, I guess.
Now, I mentioned it a short time ago, but there's two stories here. I just find them interesting. We don't really need to go into detail on these. We're kind of getting over time anyway. But, you know, some crypto scammers have been taking over YouTube accounts, and they've been doing it with malware and grabbing session cookies, right, to bypass MFA checks and just, you know, spinning up live streams saying, you know, send your Bitcoin to this address and we'll send you 10 times as much back, which I can't believe that still works.
I know.
Yeah. But it still does. But apparently a similar sort of attack, and Joe Cox has this one for Motherboard, is they've been taking over Instagram accounts and then sort of blackmailing the owners of the accounts into doing videos spruiking crypto scams that they then post on the legitimate accounts. So you would see, you know, say it's my Instagram, you'd see me there saying, hey, you know, I'm Pat Gray and you should absolutely invest your crypto tokens into this thing, and, you know, sort of ransoming their accounts back to them if they participate in the scam. And that is the most Black Mirror story we have talked about in a while.
No, it really is. Like, using the social graph and the trust in the social relationships as part of, like, Yeah, like that is some real Black Mirror shit right there.
Yeah, it's totally a Charlie Brooker invention, I think. Very, you know, very clever and evil and kind of horrible because you're making the victims a part of the crime and forcing them to do something awful. That's what
I know.
That's what's so Black Mirror about it. You can just imagine some influencer who's so gutted by losing their account that they agree to just like help rip off all of their followers. It's just
and then if you cut them in, right, and keep it going, like you build a Ponzi scheme, like a pyramid of all of these influencers who've been blackmailed and then are now getting kickbacks, and it's entirely indistinguishable from normal influencing.
Well, if you're listening to this, Mr. Charlie Brooker, there's a script idea for the next season. When is the next season of Black Mirror coming? I'm not sure. But Missouri Governor Mike Parson, this is something that happened while we were on break. A journalist he does not like right-clicked on and viewed source on some government website and discovered that they were like spitting out PII as like Base64 encoded or something. You know, all over spraying PII all over the internet, and wrote a story about it. And then the governor's like, "Oh, this person will be prosecuted for being an evil hacker," sort of thing. So, yeah,
there's not really that much to say about that, is there? Like, I mean, you know, press F12, receive personal information. It's not really computer hacking, but yeah, the InfoSec Twitter has been making a field day, you know, over this particular set of dumbassery, and I don't think they've backed down yet.
No, like, but I mean, weeks. Have charges been laid?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't look. I just don't expect. I don't expect that we really have to talk about this properly until it goes somewhere, right? Yes. At the moment, it's just a governor basically deflecting blame for a crappy security outcome, and you know, blaming a hacker. It's a playbook we've seen a million times. I don't know why anyone's surprised. Yeah. Now look. We have arrived at the, you know, and I'm looking at the counter and we're, you know, sort of towards the end of the news. And now we've arrived at the section of like 29 tabs of ransomware news that we missed.
Yeah, my active tab is in the middle of my browser session at this point. And we're an hour in.
We are at the middle tab. So look, we're not going to go in depth, but I did break this into sections, right? So while I was on break, here are some of the stories that we've had, you know, pertaining to ransomware. An Israeli hospital has cancelled elective surgery. Because of a ransomware attack. Lorenzo Franceschi Bicari at Vice reports that ransomware has disrupted 1,000 schools in America just this year. Ransomware, according to Catalin Kimpanu, ransomware attack has disrupted Toronto's public transport system. Another one from Catalin, workers have been sent home from a major automotive parts manufacturer after a ransomware attack. The largest candy corn maker in the United States got hacked ahead of Halloween. And that was critical infrastructure. That was ransomware. In proof that sometimes bad things do happen to bad people, Sinclair Broadcasting is in pandemonium apparently after a ransomware attack. I don't know what the status is there now, but they were having some trouble. The NRA as well apparently got owned. by some sort of ransomware crew. I think they're just doing a hack and leak, you know, data ransom sort of thing towards them. I don't know if they have much of an operation to be, you know, I don't know if they have much of a critical operation. I don't know enough about the NRA, I guess.
I mean, the obvious thing there is that they will demand that all Americans have the right to bear cobalt strike and go hack back against, you know, whoever did it to them. So I like that.
That was a good zinger. Thank you. Well done. Schreiber Foods, which is a dairy giant, also knocked offline by ransomware. One of the largest hotel chains in the world, Melia, also ransomwared. What else have we got? TechCrunch has reported that the Olympus US ransomware attack, which is a historical one that's been tied back to Evil Corp, which was the you know, the one facing sanctions. But you know, you're getting the idea, right? Ransomware just continues unabated.
That was a fresh ransomware attack. They had one last month and they got hit again by Evil Corp this month.
Oh, great. Crew. Okay, right. So there you go. Thank you, Adam, for just making us that, just twisting the knife that little bit more. We did see some arrests of affiliates by Europol, suspects behind Locker, Goga, Mega Cortex, and Dharma ransomware attacks. I think they're affiliates. We've got a great blog from MZsoft, and I'm going to link that in this week's show notes. They're a Kiwi company, aren't they, MZsoft?
Yeah, they're a global firm, but the boss lives in New Zealand. So they all work from home. But yes, normally a New Zealand firm, but yeah, staff all around the world.
Yeah. So they were giving DarkSide a really hard time, DarkSide Black Matter, a really hard time by secretly giving their victims decryptors, and they cost them a lot of money. And that is just such a fantastic blog post. I'd recommend people read it. Obviously, you know, it's not a sustainable solution to the ransomware problem, but it's great to see people actually doing things that that make an impact. And then, of course, there was all the stuff about about Reval freaking out and dropping tools because someone might have popped a shell or something on one of their boxes. Like, just shows these guys scare easily, right? When nothing really happened to them and they all ran, and then Darkside started moving their bitcoins around because they got scared, and then they all started releasing statements about how America is the great Satan, even though it probably wasn't America who did this stuff. And it just all got real weird, didn't it?
Yeah, it really did. We saw some reporting, though, that whoever had broken into Reval had then, like, backdoored their backups. So then when they brought up stuff, you know, after they thought they had recovered, then they brought up it with, you know.
Well, no, I think they just yanked the key material from the backups, right? So when they brought it back up, they could just use that key material to access it. I think that's what happened, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, I guess where I was heading with that is it would be a beautiful thing to see a ransomware crew owned by having their backups owned.
Yeah. So, you know,
that's what I wanted. Like, even if it's not true, who cares? I want it to be true.
Yeah. Krebs on Security reports that Conti is starting to sell access to victims, which is just, you know, again, twist the knife. We've seen them using SQLi in something called BillQuick. Like, there's just so much ransomware news. A good write-up from The Record about how Fin7 has sort of pivoted away from Carbonac and towards ransomware, and they're spinning up. They've spun up a second fake pen testing company where they interview people and then say, oh, okay, here's our client, go pen test them. And then they ransomware.
Pen testers are cheaper than criminals.
Yeah. And the FBI just put out a private industry notification saying that ransomware crews are specifically targeting companies that are about to go through mergers and acquisitions, which makes a lot of sense because they're really going to be under pressure to resolve it quickly. And that's not even all of the news, but I'm just going to dump all of those links into this week's show notes. And if you want to go through and click on all of them and just weep salty tears, dear listeners, you are absolutely free to do that. But mate, that's actually it for this week's news. Sorry to listeners that we didn't get to talk through all of that ransomware stuff, but there's just not enough time. And, especially after a couple of weeks away, there's just no time. But I think it's safe to say ransomware is still a problem.
Yes, I think so. And I think US Treasury said, what, $5.2 billion have been paid to ransomware crews? Yeah. So that's a problem. That gives you a sense of the scale.
In terms of monetary losses, I think BEC still trumps it. But the problem with ransomware is the disruption. You know, I mean, we just mentioned a hospital in Israel that couldn't do surgeries, you know. So it's not just about the money with ransomware. And I think that's something governments are realizing. And I do hear whispers on the grapevine, and as well as public statements. Governments are starting to take this seriously. And they are starting to go on the offense. We had Mike Pezzullo, who's a very powerful figure in the Australian sort of national security world in the government. He was in front of Senate Estimates saying that ASD is going hunting, quote, every night. So stuff is happening. And hopefully in coming weeks, before the year's out, we'll get to share some happy news about horrible things happening to ransomware crews.
Yeah, that would be a nice change from 29 tabs full of bad news. So
yeah, it would.
If Hounds, if you could provide us some good news, we would love that very much.
Yes, we're standing by, so please do let us know. But mate, that's it for the news. Thank you so much for joining us. It's great to be back talking to you. I did miss it, and I'll look forward to doing it again next week.
Yeah, cheers, Pat, and I'll talk to you next week.
That was Adam Boileau there with a chat about the security news we missed while I was on break. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Andrew Wilson, the CEO of Senetas. Senetas has a few different product lines, but the bulk of its business is in selling high-speed Layer 2 encryptors. If you want a 100 gigabit per second Layer 2 encryptor, there aren't too many places you can go. It's a real niche, and one that Senetas has been happily serving for decades. Well, not the 100 gig bit, but, you know, always at the sort of faster side of things. Now, you might have heard a bit in the press about the current semiconductor shortage. And yeah, it's both real and very dire. No one can get chipsets. Car makers are even giving people cash back when their new cars are delivered because they're missing some of the features that the customer has paid for. So I think it was Volvo was having to give people cash back because the auto close on the boot like wasn't installed because they didn't have enough chips. It's stuff like that. And a bunch of electronics companies are struggling as well. And even Apple is facing manufacturing delays. Over the last two decades, basically the entire world has moved to a just-in-time inventory approach, which is a great way to free up capital to use for other things. But it can be risky if something unexpected happens, like for example, a global pandemic. Now, the idea with just-in-time, or JIT, is you don't stockpile anything. Your parts are delivered to you just as you need them. And that is a model that today has been completely broken for semiconductors. As you're about to hear, though, it's not just COVID-19 that's destroyed the semiconductor supply chain and availability. It's been an almost comical number of factors that have come together and come into play to put us where we are here. Now, Cenitas is in a position where it can't service all of the immediate demand for its products. So there's a delay on some of their products, depending on the size of the order. But things could have been so much worse for them if Andrew Wilson, our next guest, hadn't have actually got on this early. Cenitas managed to secure the supplies it needed to fulfill its projected demand. But of course, demand is now spiking as the world is flush with cheap cash. And as I mentioned earlier, if you want one of their products, there is going to be a little bit of a wait on delivery. So I thought, yeah, let's get Andrew on to talk about this. Now, he's not actually an InfoSec person. He's a business person. And I'm lucky to know Andrew reasonably well. And he's the type of business person you always want to deal with. He's very smart. He's great to be around. And he's just not a bullshitter. So who better then to give us an earnest assessment of what it's like being the CEO of a company that's being majorly impacted by a supply chain disruption? Here's Andrew Wilson.
During the pandemic, during 2020, the worst of it really, we're able to do reasonably well because we had a solid pipeline of opportunities we'd been working on for years around the world with our main distribution partner, Talus, and we had plenty of inventory. And then the wheels started to fall off a little bit. In January, we started getting sort of reports about chip shortages. So we looked into it nice and quickly. And as it turns out, it was a perfect storm of a bunch of events. Firstly, had manufacturing capability shut down during the pandemic in, worldwide. And then we had an explosion of demand, right, for electronic components as a result of organizations having to move all their staff offsite and to the home. So, the demand for notebooks, tablets, and smartphones grew at more than 40%, right, at the same period, consuming a lot of the inventory in the supply chain. And at the same time, you had less manufacturing, less output. And then TSMC, one of the largest semiconductor manufacturers in the world of bleeding edge chips, which go into many of these laptops, computers, servers, and phones, etc., being hit by a 1-in-50-year drought as well. I mean, you just wouldn't
That's
read about
right.
that.
That's right. I remember reading about that now. They didn't have enough water to keep manufacturing. I think there was also a fire. There were fires at a couple of fab plants as well. Yeah,
two fires in Japan. But just back to the drought, TSMC consumes 156,000 tons of water a day.
That's
insane. What? That's insane. And then you're hit by a drought. What do you do?
Yeah.
How do you get that much water? So then two fires in Japan, the Renesas fire and the AKM fire. Then, of course, geopolitical strains with the US and US sanctions in China. And then a bit of a spat between Japan and Korea affected production. And on top of that, power shortages in Texas as a result of the big freeze shut down a lot of the fab plants.
My God. So it's not just one thing, is it? Because it's really funny because I was talking to someone today about this thing. I was saying I'm going to do this interview, blah, 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 and started talking about the semiconductor shortage. And, it really is just all of these little things at once. Like I like to play a couple of video games here and there, right? And the stuff I had to go through just to get a PS5 this year, I was joking for a while. It was like trying to get a COVID vaccine. You know what I mean? Like you had to be using like the online availability bots and wait for them to snipe availability for click and collect at Target. It's just kind of loony. Now I understand that, your business, just because you can't keep up with demand because you don't have the supplies available, you've taken a bit of a hit. But I also understand that because you got on this early, it's definitely in the could have been worse category.
Yeah, definitely. So, in January, we were seeing reports of the auto industry being affected. And we started looking into the supply chain nice and early. And then it sort of spread to the entire electronic hardware industry. So, we immediately sort of called up all of our bills of materials, looked at the lead times for our components. And literally as we were doing that, we're getting notifications from our suppliers saying that, you know, lead times are blown out from a sort of industry standard lead time of 16 weeks to 52 weeks. And we're like, oh my God, this can't, this just doesn't seem correct. We look into it more and more and, you know, and then sort of raised the flag with Thales, who were also becoming concerned. And we then decided to move from a just-in-time manufacturing process, which was, you know, had worked for us to keep inventory and working capital to a reasonable level, to an annual forecasting basis. And we just pumped in purchase orders straight into the supply chain.
But okay, but I just want to interrupt you there, because one of the craziest things in all of this is everybody abandoning JIT at the same time, ironically, has made the shortage worse because everybody's stockpiling. Now, good for you for having the foresight to do that, but it's kind of screwed everybody else.
Well, it's a bit like the toilet paper effect. Right? Everyone's now got, you know, double the number of resistors they need to manufacture a product for the next 3 years.
Yeah.
And we didn't quite go to that extent. But, you know, it does affect more than 30 different components, ranging from our most complicated, you know, FPGA chipsets, right through to power supplies and resistors. So it's not just simply a matter of, yeah, we'll buy all the long lead time components, because those long lead time components, or the ones that didn't have a long lead time, suddenly blew out, right, without notice. So we made the decision. We just had to pump in orders to manufacture a year's supply of stock, right, which is a huge capital commitment. And I guess this is where, you know, relationships are so important.
Well, okay, so amazingly, just today, the day that we're recording this interview, and of course people are going to hear this in a few weeks because I'm about to have some time off, but today we're recording this on the day that Apple announced that it was slowing down production of iPhone 13s because it couldn't get the semiconductors it needs to you know, fulfill demand, right? So, I mean, how can you expect to have a decent relationship with your semiconductor manufacturers when even Apple is having trouble, right? Like, that just blows my mind.
Yeah, well, you're right. It's crazy. I mean, if you look at the semiconductor industry, it was already operating at a 95% capacity before all of this. Mm. And then there's this huge spike in demand. There is not only no spare capacity before this pandemic, but you've had this massive spike in demand, and about 70% of that semi, you know, the bleeding edge semiconductor industry is consumed by, you know, your Apples of the world.
Yeah. Right?
So it is a real challenge to ensure we can get chipsets, even in a normal environment, for the rest of the 30. I mean, we're sort of lucky because we're not competing for the same chipsets used in notebooks, laptops, you know, servers, and iPhones.
You're not after the super in-demand stuff, I guess.
No, that's right. We're right at the bleeding edge of chipsets. So there has been a bit of availability for those chipsets, but still, we're going to wait 52 weeks.
So, but before we got recording, I was like, I asked you if there'd been a bit of a hit to business, and you were like, yeah, there has, but, you know, it's not the end of the world. So I'm guessing that hit is more a on-the-books hit for having to bring forward all of that semiconductor inventory, or like, do you have enough of it, or are you sort of at the point where you can't fulfill orders? I mean, what's been the actual effect on your business?
So the actual effect, obviously, we've been able to share the capital, working capital effect with our partners, right? And having a great relationship with Thales has been a real help, and we've been building that for 30 years, right? So, and I can't understate enough the importance of having a good relationship with your contract manufacturer, a long-term relationship with them, and long-term relationships with your channel partners, distributors. It's just critical, and ultimately your customers too. So the effect has been we've been able to secure enough stock to meet most of our revenue target, right, for the next year, all things being equal, because this is still a fluid environment, right? Just the other week, my operations guy said, mate, just I was expecting this component to arrive on this day. I've just been told a week before delivery it's not going to get delivered, right? Mm. Like, then you've got to scramble to find an alternative source of it. So, yeah, we've got more orders than we can fulfill. And the key there is to have an open dialogue with your customer. You've got to go back nice and early to say and put this fairly and squarely and firmly on the table to say, you know, it's affecting not just us, everybody else. We need to work with you in order to schedule deliveries when we can deliver. But not only that, and really, really importantly, we need to understand what your demand is over a year. Right? And if we don't get that visibility from you, it's going to be really difficult to commit to a delivery date. So I think customers now as well concerned that it's not just you know, issues with us supplying our product, but it's other networking equipment, other forms of hardware. So I think customers are coming to the party.
Certainly. So maybe some of the stuff that needs to happen before you can your gear becomes necessary, that's being delayed as well. So
that's
it's about
delayed as well.
Yeah, no, look, that makes 100% sense. It absolutely does. I mean, I suppose in this case too, like I know, you know, I've known you guys for years, right? Like Senatas has been a sponsor of the show for years. I usually pop my head in and say hello when I'm in Melbourne. We all go to lunch and that sort of thing. And I know that your sales cycles for the type of equipment you sell, layer two encryption equipment is still, you know, the bulk of your business. The lead times for that are really, really long. And I'm guessing in a case like this, thank your lucky stars that you're not, you know, a company that is expected to, you know, just deliver stuff when it's ordered yesterday, right? Like,
well, the customers still expect that, but yeah. You know, I think,
but it takes them a long time to order, I guess, is what I'm saying. Like these are usually components of large projects. So it's not stuff that's, you know, it's not like everybody who needed a Chromebook when the pandemic first hit, you know what I mean? Yeah, this is right, stuff that requires planning. So
yeah, it's infrastructure in many
yeah,
cases.
Yeah, exactly.
But the thing that scares me is, you know, in our pipeline, we've got lots of big, big deals, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, that we've been working on for a long period of time. Now, it's hard to estimate when they come in because they're tied to federal government infrastructure budgets running into the hundreds of millions of dollars. And, you know, if those things start to fire up, then I'll be in this awful situation of having lots of demand but not being able to deliver it. And obviously your concern as a company is that those organizations might look for alternatives to fulfill their needs. And hopefully that doesn't happen. But I don't see this chip shortage being resolved anytime soon.
I mean, the latest forecasts I've read, they've said something like a year. It's funny, right? Because my undergraduate degree was in electronics engineering and we studied JIT supply chains at uni. Yeah. And this is in the 90s. And they're like, JIT supply chains are great unless something unexpected happens, right? So, and here we are.
Here we are.
But I mean, this is the thing. I mean, you and I were talking before we started recording and it's like, you know, are people going to go for a software alternative? And like, well, software alternatives already exist. If people are buying high-speed layer two encryptors, like that's because they need a high-speed layer two encryptor and it needs to be hardware. So it is a interesting situation where I can't imagine a customer of yours pivoting off elsewhere, right? Because your competitors are going to have the same issues when it comes to actually being able to cater to supply. But look, anyway, the latest forecasts I've heard say things should rebalance next year. That's what they're saying. So if things sort out in 9 months from now, I mean, you'd think, you know, things will be better for you. But I can tell that it's the CEO's worst nightmare, which is a flood of huge purchase orders and no basic components to fulfill them.
I've got to come to Jesus meeting tomorrow morning about an opportunity we won in Brazil, you know, running into the hundreds of units that sort of came out of nowhere. So,
You've got to sit down and work out if you can actually fulfill it.
Yeah. And I'm getting lots of pressure from, you know, sales guys wanting to meet their annual quotas, right? So, Andrew, can you work some miracles? I'll do my best.
So where is that at? I mean, is it the case that there are still some pockets of supply that you're trying to tap into, alternate supply, things like that? Or at this point, you've pretty much exhausted Yeah, okay.
We've exhausted that. Yeah. We've begged, borrowed, and stole from anywhere we can. So, you know, my estimates is it's going to be hard right through 2022. I think it's probably going to ease up in 2023 as more capacity comes online. But, you know, to add more capacity to these fab plants, it takes 1 to 3 years. I mean, it's a $450 billion market, which is highly concentrated and massively capital intensive, right? So just to keep up with chip advances, right, for new chips in the future requires $110 billion of continuous investment over a decade.
Mm.
Right, so this is, you know, this is not an industry that can change quickly due to the, you know, sheer capital requirements. So, at the moment, if you just with the existing products that these semiconductor fabrication manufacturing plants put out, just to increase supply 5 to 10% is likely to cost $40 billion. All right. And just to give you an example, it can take 26 weeks to create one single chip. And there are more than 1,000 steps in making some of these chips.
Yeah.
So it's insane. But, you know, I think help's on the way. And the reason for that is partly geopolitical. You know, not having access to bleeding edge chipsets or chipsets full stop, given the concentration of the supply of these chipsets, like TSMC, almost has a monopoly on bleeding edge chips.
Mm.
And what we're talking about is a single supply of the most complicated chipsets on earth being supplied by a single company in Taiwan.
Yeah. Right?
So, and that's geopolitically at the moment, I'm sure we all follow the news, a little bit tense. So it's caused governments around the world to think, geez, if we can't secure our own supply, it's a threat to national security. So you've got the US government announcing a program, $52 billion of investment to bolster its own capability to produce chipsets. We've got Intel, who will invest $20 billion to build more fab plants in Arizona. The EU is going to invest $160 billion in fabrication and semiconductor industries.
Because, yeah, well, I mean, this has shown us, right, that if something were to happen to Taiwan, I mean, it could be a little bit tricky, you know?
Oh, it's going to get a bit tense.
Yeah.
So hopefully that doesn't happen. It could bring, you know, the high-tech industry to its knees.
So I guess, look, for any customers or interested parties listening, I guess the thing is, you know, contact Zenitas if you need to order something. Put in your order and then you're going to sit down and work out a delivery estimate, and that's the best you can do, but they might be waiting a little while. Is that about where you've left things with customers?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, you might say that, but 4 weeks later they say, where's our product?
But I guess, so what if I were to order a, you know, a 100 gigabit per second full line rate encryptor today?
Yeah, you're going to wait a year.
Yeah, right. It's that long. But I mean, your lead time for sales from the moment a lead comes in, your pipeline is a slow moving one. I mean, typically, but as you said, right, Brazil just rocked up and I like, hey.
Give us some.
Yeah.
So, you know, but generally speaking, it's about a year.
Yeah.
A year to 18 months, sometimes 2 to 3 years.
And what are your suppliers saying?
At the moment, they're saying, guess what? There's a price increase of 20%. Thanks very much.
But I mean, you know, your margins would be pretty good, right? So I can't imagine eating that would be terribly difficult for you.
No, it's not too bad. And, you know, in some cases we've been able to pass on, you know, a proportion of that cost increase to customers, not all of it, unfortunately.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, thank you very much for joining us to talk about a topic. And I'm really happy that you're happy to come on and talk about a topic about, you know, having your works gummed up by this situation, because I think we need people to think about this, which is, it's really why I suggested the topic and wanted to talk to you about it, because I knew you would have some interesting things to say about it and some great perspective on it. So, Andrew Wilson, thank you so much for joining us on the show to have that conversation. I found that absolutely fascinating.
Great. Thanks, Patrick. Really appreciate the time.
That was Andrew Wilson there, the chief executive of Zenitas and all-round nice guy. So, yeah, if you want to buy one of their encryptors, plan ahead. Meanwhile, don't bank on their competition being able to help you either, because everybody's in the same boat. So, you know, bad time for everybody. You can check out Zenitas at zenitas.com, Zenitas.com. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. We'll